Welcome to the Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later.
Offshoreization creates a double economy with two different sets of rules, or rather, you know, in one part there are basically no rules and the other one is regulated. It's so important for people, for politicians, governments to understand this is what they are doing to their own economy by turning a blind eye to the offshoreization.
We look at Iceland and the offshoreization of a whole economy. But first, here's a high-speed blast through this month's Tax Justice news. What do you do when your daughter's being prosecuted for tax fraud? Well, Spain's King Juan Carlos allegedly offered 2 million euros in cash to stop the trial. How touching. The trial continues. Also in Spain, its biggest corruption trial for years has just begun of 37 people, including leading members of Spain's ruling Popular Party and three former treasurers. All thanks, by the way, to the whistleblower and now ex-civil servant Ana Garrido. By the way, there's no protections for whistleblowers in Spain. And to add to the party's embarrassment, a Popular Party PowerPoint presentation has emerged this month which seems to show how it taught its mayors to channel illegal funds into election campaigns. France has strengthened whistleblower protection with a new anti-corruption law. It's not perfect, but according to LuxLeaks whistleblower Antoine Deltour, it's a step forward and it would have protected him had it been in place. Meanwhile, the European Union continues to drag its feet on this front line for tax justice. Australia's in the midst of an enormous gas export boom, but you wouldn't think it, because it turns out that Australia's oil and gas tax may raise no extra revenue for decades. To add insult to injury, Aussies will be paying three times more tax on beer by 2018 than the oil and gas tax will raise. Better keep the drinks flowing then. In the United States, it looks like presidential candidate Donald Trump may have avoided paying any federal income taxes for nearly two decades. He famously claimed that makes him smart. Well, US Americans don't think it's smart to avoid your taxes. They think it's unethical. According to research by fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, Vanessa Williamson, more US Americans believe the Apollo 11 moon landing was faked than disagree with the statement, "It is every US American's civic duty to pay their fair share of taxes." Who knew? Those are some of the Tax Justice news headlines for this month. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, let's start with Brazil, because effective from the 1st of this month, Ireland is now on its tax haven blacklist, and as well Austria, Curaçao and St. Martin. Companies based in the blacklist will have to start paying a 25% tax rate on the business that they're doing. An example of that, 520 of the aircraft flying around Brazil at the moment are leased from companies registered in Ireland, where they enjoy very cosy, favourable tax rules. So it's interesting, Brazil's previously shown it's quite willing to act independently rather than waiting around for the OECD to do anything about all this. What effect does that have on business decisions that companies might make? What effect does it have on tax havens like Ireland, this kind of thing?
This is going to come as quite a big blow for the Irish government, and they have already reacted, requesting Brazil to change its position. Brazil is, of course, one of the world's biggest trading nations, a huge locus for investment. And as you say, Brazil for a very long time has gone its own way on tax matters. It doesn't, for example, apply the OECD's approach on transfer pricing. It has said that that approach doesn't work for them. They go for a profit split mechanism and they tend to look more at economic substance. Although Ireland nominally charges a 12.5% tax rate, in practice, it's largely used as a conduit country through which profits are shifted onto subsidiaries in other tax havens. So companies based in Brazil which are using subsidiaries in Ireland are by and large able to avoid a very considerable amount of tax. So when Ireland is included on the Brazilian tax haven list alongside Austria and San Martin and so on. This will impact a number of companies which have Irish subsidiaries, since those subsidiaries can no longer be included in their accounts consolidation, that is the consolidation of their total foreign earnings and any losses which they're booking in Brazil. So this ruling is likely to have a very really major effect on several key sectors of the Brazilian economy. You've already mentioned the airline sector, and it's absolutely the case that many of the Brazilian airlines are leasing their aircraft through subsidiaries in Ireland precisely because they can then charge a huge amount in order to ship profits out of Brazil and into Ireland. This will impact many of the low-cost operators and possibly even some of the higher cost operators in Brazil. And that's a very big issue. I imagine it will also impact much of the agribusiness sector. Remember, Brazil exports a lot of agricultural produce, including meats. One of the world's largest meat exporters and trading companies is Brazilian, and they may well have to reconsider how they will structure themselves globally. In fact, one of the biggest meat packing companies in Brazil has already said it might shift its proposed subsidiary away from Ireland and into London, which of course is another major tax haven.
Not yet on Brazil's tax haven blacklist.
Not yet, that's right, not yet on the Brazilian tax list. But watch this space.
Yeah, so it's bad news for Ireland. And I mean, in the absence of proper OECD measures taken globally that can be agreed globally and implemented, you know, countries like Brazil, they are big enough to take these kind of measures by themselves, increase their tax revenue in the process. But in terms of tax haven blacklists, it is, whilst they are a good idea in some ways, in another way, it's in the absence of proper measures globally. We should say, if you search for the tax havens blacklist articles on the TJN website, you'll find all kinds of stories on how easy it is for countries to get off global blacklists like the OECD blacklist and things like that.
That is the trouble with the blacklists that have been issued in the past. The OECD blacklists have been notoriously political in their construct, largely not including OECD countries like Switzerland and Netherlands and Ireland and so on, not to mention the United States and United Kingdom. And it's a real danger when countries on an ad hoc basis nominate some jurisdictions as tax havens like Ireland, but don't include Switzerland, which is the case with Brazil, don't include the United States, don't include the United Kingdom. This is a little bit arbitrary. We do need to move towards a more rational system, defining not only what is a tax haven, which jurisdictions are a tax haven, but whether it's just about tax. We, of course, the Tax Justice Network, have focused as much on secrecy as on tax. Now, Ireland is not a secrecy jurisdiction. It is clearly a tax haven in the conventional sense of helping multinational companies to avoid paying tax. But it is definitely not a secrecy jurisdiction. Neither is the Netherlands, but Switzerland definitely is. And their non-inclusion on a blacklist is a very odd decision.
Right. Let's stay in Latin America and talk about Panama, because there's a very interesting thing happening there this month. Panama has just passed a new law, unanimously, by the way, that would impose sanctions and retaliatory measures on any person, country or international organisation that accuse it of being a tax haven, or rather, as they put it, anyone who discriminates against the Republic of Panama. Interestingly, and it's linked to the Brazil story, they brought this in after France put it on its tax haven list. And it's even said that the OECD could be targeted by this new law, because the OECD recently has come out and been very critical of Panama. So, I mean, if I was a criminal, I would be hearing very strong signals from Panama that I should definitely keep my money there. And they are under pressure because apparently since the Panama Papers scandal, the number of companies being incorporated there is expected to drop by about 20% this year.
Yeah, do you know, I see Panama a bit like a drunk who's staggering down the road and doesn't realise that the rest of the world is actually laughing at it. This measure is, at one level, truly laughable. because they've gone from one PR disaster to the next. If just look at the last couple of years, they've been persistently refusing to cooperate with Transparency and Anti-Money Laundering Initiative to the extent that the OECD, the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, has singled them out as one of the least cooperative jurisdictions on the planet. That alone is not good news. Then they had the Panama leaks, and they were across the newspapers. And we all know that the Panama leaks also implicated places like British Virgin Islands, but as a public relations disaster, this is a catastrophe. Then they had the resignation of some of the key people they appointed to the new commission to clean up their act, including Nobel Prize winning economist Joseph Stiglitz. Now, by this stage, you'd have thought they'd realised they were heading for a gigantic mess. Now to come forward with this bit of legislation, which, as you say, was passed unanimously, tells me that this is a serious drunk and they're colliding with everything they beat down as they go down the pavement. Threats to retaliate against states, against international agencies, against journalists, possibly even against NGOs that accused Panama of being a tax haven. This tells us that they're not living in the real world. And particularly since the retaliation they're talking about can take the form of some fairly serious measures, tax and tariff impositions, labour movement restrictions, even possibly criminal and legal sanctions against people, which might extend to blocking people from actually entering the country. Now, Panama, this is a jurisdiction that's completely out of control. Panama is not just a major secrecy jurisdiction. It is a politically delinquent secrecy jurisdiction which deserves to be placed on every single tax haven blacklist on the planet, which presumably means I won't be visiting Panama in the near future.
No, that's right, because if we were standing in Panama now saying all this, presumably the handcuffs would be on us already and would Absolutely. Be led off to a Panamanian jail. So, I mean, I just wonder how Panamanians feel about this, because, and also civil society groups in Panama and journalists there and organisations and politicians who might want to be critical. I believe there's some Tax Justice Network event that's going to be happening there later this year. Perhaps they'll actually try to refuse entry or arrest somebody. I mean, how far are they prepared to go? That's the interesting question.
I think probably we must assume that they'll go all the way. They are now moving away from a democratic country where civil society can interact freely, where journalists can live without fear of being arrested, to an increasingly autocratic model, and that must be very worrying indeed. And that's why I think Panama now deserves to have strong international sanction imposed upon it to make sure it doesn't proceed down this highly autocratic, highly secretive, highly non-cooperative model, because the only people who will benefit from that are the criminals.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. This month, we're in Iceland. A small, beautiful, prosperous country of sand and lava fields, mountains, glaciers and volcanoes. The population is only around 330,000 people, and the United Nations Human Development Index ranks it as the 13th most developed country in the world. But in 2008, 22,000 very angry Icelanders came out to protest on the streets. That's about 10% of the adult population, because all three of Iceland's privately owned banks had collapsed spectacularly. By the time they went bust, they'd ballooned to 9 times the size of Iceland's entire GDP. That means that relative to the size of its economy, this was the biggest banking collapse in history. Icelandic journalist Ingólfur Sigfússon describes the moments that changed everything in Iceland on ABC Radio National.
Of time be in a position to have to explain the concept of sovereign default to people. Western nation is bankrupt. And what does that even mean? Does that mean that the currency that I have in my hand is worthless? Does it mean that we can't do business with the outside world? Does it mean that in a few weeks there'll be nothing left on the shelves of the supermarkets, that we won't get petrol for our cars and airplanes and fishing fleet? What does all of this mean? And that's a very strange place, but that's where we were at in 2008.
October 2008, the Prime Minister at the time, Geir Horte, gave a speech where he explained the emergency laws that would be put in place in order to enable the government to deal with the banks.
Icelandic journalist and Morning Macro podcaster Sigrun Davíðsdóttir.
There was this atmosphere of great uncertainty, and everybody was hit. You would have to go to the shop to buy something, and the krona was collapsing. So the prices were going up, and people lost their jobs. A big part of the public sector took on pay cuts, and pay cuts in general were quite common. Everybody was affected. The collapse in the economy was sharp and great.
So how did it come to this? How did Iceland get to this point?
Banks were privatized in Iceland in the years 1998 until 2002. One of the state banks actually was announcing in 1998 that it was buying a bank in London because it was going to offer offshore services. And there was a whole page interview in one of the biggest Icelandic newspapers about the glories of offshoreization. And nobody had at that time realized that, you know, this was a really devious thing to do. So offshoreization came very quickly. The interesting thing about the Icelandic offshoreization is that it became a common thing to do. So instead of being just offering this to high net worth individuals, big companies, this was basically, we could almost say, a high street product. So this was being offered so widely to so many people, and it was mainly the banks selling this as a way of getting fees.
Yeah, because you say key to these products was tax minimization, right? I mean, if you pay for offshore fees and all the rest of it, it doesn't justify the expense unless tax minimization was key.
Absolutely. And they were also saying to their clients, I mean, look, it's really clever. You can kind of operate offshore and nobody knows what you're doing. That was another aspect of it. I mean, you were almost like nobody if you didn't have an offshore company, if you owned any fairly small amount of money. So there was a owner of a small fishing boat. He sold the boat for something like £125,000. And this was something that the bank thought was quite enough to set up an offshore company. Now, lo and behold, this man got into great difficulty later on because he didn't know how to get out of it and so on. So, I mean, this definitely didn't serve the needs of the client in this case, and this was so often the case.
So what were they doing with all this money? Because they were amassing this money not only from Iceland, but whole councils were in Britain, for example, were banking with Icelandic banks, and they were offering crazy interest rates which were not available in the rest of Europe. So what was going on there?
Well, this started to happen in 2006 when foreign banks and banking analysts and so on started to scrutinize what sort of banking they were doing. And they were somewhat worried because there was a lot of cross ownership and the main shareholders were very big and they seemed to be big clients at the banks as well. So there were worries and the funding basically dried up, the wholesale international funding that they had been getting on international markets. So they had to find something else, and what they thought, okay, we will start to offer bank accounts with high interest rates. And this was going very well until the end. It was quite remarkable how much money they actually did get. Now, what were they doing with the money? Well, they were lending it out. Shockingly high loans that the largest shareholders had in the banks and the business partners of these shareholders. So banking the Icelandic way was basically you had banks which were sort of divided in two, or the two-tier banks. You had the big shareholders who were getting very favorable loans, often with very soft covenants and shaky collaterals. So this was where the large amount of loans were going. And then you had just normal retail banks where due diligence was done and so on. And that was basically for everybody else. I mean, there was a Sputnik growth in the Icelandic banking sector. And being such a small country with such a big banking sector is inherently dangerous and is a challenge to financial stability.
And presumably when the banks were privatised, there was also an environment of deregulation, or checks and balances were removed. Was that part of the process?
Yes, it was part of the process. And, you know, we have to remember at the time, this was when people believed in light touch regulation, not only in Iceland, but also in the UK and the US and so on. A major reason for the collapse in 2008 was because of this. And the feature of banking regulation in Iceland at the time was that there were far too few people working with the regulators. They didn't really have the experience. Banking was fairly, it wasn't new in Iceland, but you know, on this scale, it was new. So they just couldn't follow up. And you know, every time somebody with a regulator got trained in what he was doing, some bank offered her or him a job, and off he went to work with the bank. So, I mean, the rotating doors, they were all sort of rotating in one way. So, I mean, there was a huge understaffing and underfunding, really.
I think Guernsey and certainly Luxembourg featured very heavily in the business that these banks were doing. You actually went to Luxembourg and you were asking all kinds of questions about various cases that you were looking into at the time, and they were not very helpful.
Well, Luxembourg was certainly at the core of the operations of the Icelandic banks. And we can see through the court cases and the charges that most of the dubious stuff, let's say, was done in Luxembourg. Yes, it's true. I mean, I did go there. I got meetings with people from the regulator, and no, there didn't seem to be any profound interest in looking more closely at these things, although they were all being investigated in Iceland. And I find it somewhat perplexing, to say the very least, that Luxembourg hasn't taken the steps itself to investigate what was going on in the banks which were operating there.
Unless they don't want to know.
No, there is nothing to indicate that they would like to know. After all, Luxembourg is at the heart of the European Union, houses the parliament and important institutions, and I find it actually a bit of a scandal.
Right, and Iceland, famously, unlike the rest of Europe, took strong and very different measures against the banks and the bankers after the crisis, didn't they?
Well, when the banks collapsed in Iceland, there was a strong sense that something had been going very wrong and that possibly criminal deeds had been done and this needed to be investigated. And one thing was to set up an office of a special prosecutor who would then look into cases related to the banks. And yes, that was done. And yes, the outcome of that have been some criminal charges, and the outcome of these charges have been bankers condemned to prison sentences. There are about 20-25 people who have actually been sentenced and gone to prison. At the time when Iceland collapsed and there were all these measures taken, a lot of foreign investors were extremely upset. I mean, they were obviously seeing huge losses, and all of this was very shocking. However, in the hindsight, the fact that these measures were taken was a big help. Iceland didn't do what Europe has been doing, sort of lingering in a limbo and not really tackling the big issues. We can see that the European banking sector is struggling, and now obviously with Italian banks, with Deutsche Bank and so on. Now, this is very much down to the fact that the painful things have been avoided. So I often say, you know, Iceland shows that a quick stab is better than a lingering pain. Iceland took the quick stab. It was extremely painful at the time, but at least things have and are slowly being cleared out. And that makes a huge difference compared to so many European countries where the lingering pain is still there.
And one of the features of offshore is that it's very easy to cream off the assets and spirit them away somewhere. Makes the recovery process difficult because, you know, the assets have gone somewhere else and it's difficult to find it, to trace it.
That's correct. And what we have seen in Iceland, we have seen absolutely spectacular bankruptcies with enormous debt and very little asset. And I often say that for these sort of private individuals who have been owning these big holding companies, it is, of course, absolutely staggering that so little can be recovered. And if you look at offshoreization, it's like a centrifuge. So you put stuff in there and then over time you separate assets and debt. And if you're very clever about it, you know, the company that owns all the debt goes bankrupt and the assets have gone somewhere else. And although they are out of sight, I am sure that they are not necessarily out of sight for the people who own these companies. Very, very wealthy Icelanders.
Yeah, and offshoreization has had other longer term cultural effects as well in terms of attitudes to paying tax, right?
Absolutely. The fact that people could, well, let's say, so easily keep their assets abroad, keep their assets out of sight of the tax authorities, may lead to a certain change of mind in terms of taxing, that taxing becomes optional. The sort of slow erosion of understanding of the necessity that we all pay tax. I mean, I remember when I was a kid and I heard my father say, well, it's good to pay a lot in tax because it means that you are a high earner. And now, if you are a high earner and you pay a lot in tax, it basically means you are an idiot. Very, very dangerous.
And what's interesting about Iceland is the speed at which this toxic way of doing business just becomes normal. And you end up with this kind of double economy, the seen and the unseen, two-tier system.
Well, the effect of offshoreization is that this effect is actually not offshore, it's onshore. It is in Iceland. So if you create an offshore economy, the economy is like a balloon. This balloon is not floating out in the Pacific or wherever, it's actually hovering in Iceland. So everybody who has something offshore has like a vacuum in Iceland, where this person can wheel and deal and own assets and keep them hidden, hide ownership, evade taxes. So all of this, it's going on in Iceland, in the country, via offshore companies. And that is the sort of crystallization of what offshore really means. It means that onshore, you can do loads of things out of sight, hidden, nobody sees it. So that creates like a double economy inside the country. So there is the visible economy where, you know, everybody is visible, competition, regulation affects that part of the economy, tax and so on. And then you have this invisible part where you are actually playing with things in your economy, in your country, but nobody can see it. It creates a double economy with two different sets of rules, or rather, you know, in one part there are basically no rules and the other one is regulated. And this is something I think it's so important for people, for politicians, governments to understand. This is what they are doing to their own economy by sort of turning a blind eye to the offshoreization.
Did as a result of what happened with this whole process of offshoreization, deregulation of banking and all of that, did Iceland re-regulate?
Ah, that's a good question. To a certain degree, yes. There has been a change in rules and regulations. Financial Services Authority has been strengthened. The tax authorities have been strengthened. There is definitely a lot of sympathy for regulators. However, I find it very interesting that what has been talked about ever since the collapse of the banks, which is separating retail banking from investment banking, has not been put in place. And is that because they think that it will be easier to sell the banks with this sort of joint possibility of operations? And if so, then, I mean, that's, to my mind, an open danger, because that means that, well, I very much doubt it will be done after the banks will be sold. So it's a very worrying sign. I think this should have been, in terms of priorities, absolutely essential.
That's it for this month. Thanks for listening. You can read Sigrun Davíðsdóttir's ICE log on www.uti.is. We'll be back next month.